I'm going to do. Not only are there terrible winters, but I want to move to a place where I've got this idea for a TV show, and I want to do the Appalachian Trail in six different sections with six different comedians who teach me their style of comedy, but I'm going to teach them how to thru hike. And we'll spend a month on trail where we're doing this journey together. We're going to prepare for a mini show at the end of each one of our sections or episodes and call it the Walk of Shame, because a thru hike is a grueling, fun, unique experience, and so is becoming a comedian. And I wanted to try to capitalize on this. Okay, I've got this niche market in thru hiking. It's one of my passions. I love it. I've got this niche market in comedy where I want to sell, not that I'm a complete comedian, but I'm on a journey both on a hike and to become a comedian. So I'm going to try to give myself 5 to 6 months to sell that towards a production company or a TV company or something, where hopefully somebody, we're getting close to the end of the time. I'm getting my light. I go on these long tangents. I'm hoping to sell a TV show. That's it.
That's cool. That is exciting. Where would people find you if they wanted to follow you on the internets and the social medias?
I think Instagram is best. It's a nightmare to explain to people, but it's Sean Powers, all one word. But you have to type the whole thing out. SeanPowersAllOneWord.
Sean Powers, all one word.
Sean Powers, all one word.
Really appreciate your time. I'm very exciting for you. You've taken quite a journey, and I think you're just beginning another one here with your comedy. And good luck to you. I'm really looking forward to seeing you on stage and seeing you succeed, and maybe see you on a TV screen someday.
Hey, thank you so much. Don't for show business, don't say good luck, say break a leg. But for hiking, say good luck, don't say break a leg. So you know what? Just I'm going to take the good luck because I'm going to need it.
Thank you once again, Sean Powers.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, that is Sean Powers. I'm Trevor Collins with Times Like Now. Thank you for tuning in to the program. You can find past episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. I'm Trevor, and I can be reached, Trevor@timeslikenow.com. I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Had him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you are listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Ilka Demirkuparan. She runs the Ministry of Post-Collapse Art and Culture Gallery with her sister Vuslat D. Katsanis, and that is in the Ford Building on Division. And she's here today talking about the new show 1989, which opens October the 8th and closes November 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Ilka.
Well, thank you for having me over. Thank you so much.
So we're in this small gallery space, which is only on its third show. It's in the second floor of the Ford Building, which is
11th and Division.
11th and Division. And it's basically, it's a white cube gallery. You've laid the work out. It's not hung, but it's sort of in position. And the title is 1989, which I immediately thought of the fall of the Berlin Wall, but as you pointed out, it was also the Tiananmen Square conflict and then also the fall of apartheid in South Africa. So big year. You talk to artists about, you know, what does 1989 mean to you? And just generalize a little bit about the perspective that you were looking for.
So as an artist-run space, we call ourselves also a think tank. As artists ourselves, we've been looking to contextualize our work and what are we doing and why are we doing it in this time and of our life in this moment in history. And we come to the realization that like post-war Europe There's a term that was invented to isolate that rupture in space and time that profoundly affected the way artists thought about their work. But it was a collective existential moment everywhere. It was, you know, like you see post-war artists of Japan after the atomic bomb. You see a big rupture in Korea with Dansa Ekva movement, where their country divided into two, and Europe reduced to rubble. And it has changed the way we think collectively as humanity, because it is that collective moment of how did we get here? And to identify that change, that rupture, we decided to use post-war art as a term to have a marker in time to identify the works of those artists. And since then, we know when you look at the art world and how the artists are working and functioning, there is some changes that are happening, and there's something that is different, and everybody knows it and feels it, but we haven't really identified that moment. And so when we think about it, well, when was the last time something so pivotal happened that we still feel its effect ripple through time? And that was 1989. That was when we had a global shift where the Tiananmen Square and the fall of the Berlin Wall, opening up of what was hidden, locked behind the Iron Curtain, and ideas travel between those spaces that were previously off limits. So we decided, okay, that was the ripple, that was the rupture in space and time that has affected all of us all the way here in the United States. And that was 1989. And 1989 was marked by a collapse of so many things. So that's why we came up with the term post-collapse to explain this and establish a theoretical framework to contextualize the work of artists that are practicing today. And so this show is in a way our inaugural show to begin unpacking the art theory that we're working on as a think tank. And so this is what this show is about. And we have artists from Portland, local, from Hong Kong, from Russia, from Czech Republic, and from Mexico, from Switzerland, and Serbia in this show.
Let's look at the piece from Russia is by Anna Sayarova, mm-hmm. and it's called Comrade Che. Mm-hmm. And Che was a children's character, an animation on Soviet state TV.
Yes.
And you say he was a Winnie the Pooh, a very lovable, harmless character.
Yeah.
But this artist has produced a kind of piece of needlework which doesn't really look like any kind of animal. You know, it looks like an octopus because there are birch trees that look like tendrils below, and the head is this big brown felted sort of oval, extended oval. There's kind of a face with orange dots, and there's this traditional sort of Russian looking needlework, you know, geometric needlework. So why does she present this? It's half drawing, half fabric. And then tell us a bit about the character, Che.
So Comrade Che, or his full name, Cherubushka, was a Winnie the Pooh-like character, the beloved children's. And Comrade, I guess, is your friend, your buddy. Buddy Che would be, I guess, the direct translation. So for her, as the artist describes it, she uses the birch trees because that's a native plant. And she focuses on the roots of the tree. And a lot of, communism was used to instill the Russian identity. Part of what communism did was to get rid of religion and get rid of, you know, superstitious thinking and a lot of that stuff, and to collectively organize around certain ideals that made the Russian society. So the idea of communism was ingrained with Russian identity. Even though communism is a political system, it's not a cultural phenomenon. So Comrade Che was the space, and because it was a children's show, it wasn't as heavily monitored. So they would sometimes talk about ideas that would be too dangerous and risky in adult grown-up TV shows. But he was able to criticize more freely from that space of innocence. So there's one layer of sign to Comrade Che. But also, with the fall of the Soviet Union, so did the state television. There was nobody there to animate this character. So there's a sense of loss of your buddy that died too, and it's from this innocent children's perspective mm-hmm. of everybody lost something, and you know, Anna lost her buddy Che.
Is Anna in Russia now?
Yes, she lives in Moscow.
So how did you get her work? You know, how did you get in touch?
We had an open call where we wrote about, you know, it's high time we define our moment. And we gave a little bit of a paragraph of our thinking, you know, in a very traditional old school way, made a call. And we saw artists responded in the very old school traditional way, not like submit their applications. And everything that is in this show is like very, very touching, like it's a genuine, sincere response. And this was one of them.
You mean they made new art based on the call?
It wasn't new art, it was existing work. Mm-hmm. Because the call was like, who else is out there, you guys? Like, who else is thinking about our moment? And so this was one of the works that was in response to our call, but already existing.
An artist called Katya has a piece. It looks like a sort of 18-inch high blob, brown. It's made of cork and resin. So it's chopped up corks that have been molded into a shape, and then as you look around the back you realize there's a indentation, and then you had to explain this, but it's a mold of the inside of a mouth. So it's the negative, it's the space in your mouth rendered mm-hmm. solid as a cork. There's the teeth indentations. What was Katya up to?
Well, Katya was thinking about the 80s, about this dystopian future where we envisioned a future where our biology would be used to track, rule us, and control us. So this piece is, you know, it's the inside of a mouth that has been numb, blown up. And her other work are fingerprints and ear scans and things like that. Like,
is that a thing?
I mean, you know, the passports used to do the thing with the ear in America.
Oh, I didn't know.
Or, you know, they scan your face for mm-hmm. certain markers, and ears are apparently as unique as fingerprints. So the curves and the ripples and the cartilages.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can't really, you know, get a plastic surgery, but you can't change your ear. Mm-hmm. So they would be like giveaways, which is why the American passports were like obsessed with the ear. Her work is about the time in which we, with the 80s, envisioned how today would be so depressing. And so this piece is a bit of an homage to that, that we are living that nightmare that people in the 80s feared.
In terms of tracking everyone?
In terms of tracking. I'm a fan of technology, but it is a bit scary if you think about it.
Yeah. This Swiss artist,
Naomi Mittelman,
she has done a really interesting piece. It's like, so it's a regular frame, but the canvas is more like screen, like you'd kind of like you would have on your window at home, you know, to keep the bugs out, but it's white. Then there are four red parallel bars of red paint done by a spray can. There are pencil drawings of the shapes look like contours on a map. And then the bottom right corner has a sort of square of canvas that's been painted with a big circle cut out the middle, and it's been stapled on, and it sort of overlaps the frame. What does Naomi's work usually talk about?
So Naomi is also an artist whose parents are German and American, and growing up, her father made it a point to go see Drive to the Wall, to talk about it as a dividing and a force in Europe that was like the symbol.
And so were they living in Germany?
They were living in Switzerland at the time, and she's like, her family migrated back to the United States, but then she decided to go back to mm-hmm. Switzerland and continue living there. And she explores that idea of divide and rupture and nomad way of living, which is why her materials are very light and also fragile, but also look like they were patched together from remnants of something else, or like the graffiti of things that people would tag on the wall itself. And also when you think about the history of how Switzerland was able to avoid the war in World War II, that, you know, reduced Europe to rubble, And also afterwards, they had to rebuild, but then the conflict started again, and then the wall was erected. So it seems to be a reoccurring theme in our history. It is an unresolved period, and she her work visits that wall to talk about today. But because it is unresolved, things aren't settled. Her materials reflect that insecurity. It looks unrefined. It looks fragile also, easy to be destroyed, and also as if she just made use of whatever was there, which is kind of like how we are going about now, in a sense. It really reflects how we live today, mm-hmm. our contemporary moment. It's like we're like just, we haven't really resolved things, and the pandemic made that really clear with the problems that it surfaced, that we were almost like, yeah, we are very fragile.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Ilka Demirkupuran. She is running the Ministry of Post-Collapse Art and Culture, which is gallery and think tank in the Ford Building on Division. And she's talking about their new show, 1989. Over here, you have a painting by a Portland artist. It looks kind of like an R. Crumb face. It's a guy in profile, sort of cartoony. He's got very jagged teeth, a long sort of cartoon nose. He's outlined in brown oil stick, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And then below that are two layers of, you know, red and blue sort of abstractions, and they've been covered up in white. And then the actual bare white canvas is visible, you know, around the edges. Who's this artist, and why is a Portlander in this show about 1989?
The artist is Nathaniel Proska. He was one of the artists who also responded to our call, very specifically from the American experience since the fall of the Berlin Wall. He said that his parents came to the United States from the former Czechoslovakia, and they integrated into the American, you know, keep your head down, work hard, save your money, and just keep working hard, and you will have a chance at the American dream. And that was the life, and ironically, we are actually at the Ford Building talking about that and the collapse of the American dream. So his work touches on that idea of the world that we came into in the 80s, and the idea of working hard and having a chance, and then with the fall of the Berlin Wall, communism was declared, ooh, look, that was a failed experiment. Marxism, ooh, you know, that's dead. And it gave permission for capitalism to have this ruthless rise. And so he uses, in his work, he uses aesthetics of poverty, like graffitied walls that are then whitewashed, that are then graffitied over again, or these very haphazardly drawn pictures that are references to the poor. And he uses the teeth especially, because he says teeth are indications of how the poor are. They are essential for your survival, to eat and to get nourishment. But in America, strangely, they're not covered in your healthcare, if you can even afford healthcare. So he uses these monsters as references, these very like demonized figures that represent how the poor are seen in this country as though they are the problem that people shun. But in effect, like, they are the people that have been neglected through this unchecked monster that has just gotten worse and worse. And I always give this example. There was a study done in the 80s. If you got your college degree from a university, in your first 5 years, you could pay off your student loans or work the summers and pay off your tuition that way if you didn't want to borrow money. Get a car, pay it off in that first 5 years, put aside enough money for a down payment on your home, get married, have a baby, and start saving for retirement in your first 5 years. Whereas I, along with so many people in my generation, we graduated with a very threatening letter saying that if you ever default on your student loan payment, we will take your Social Security pay, which is going to be like, what, $300 a month, you know? So it's like with this angry, threatening letter from the government saying you're going to die under a bridge somewhere, so better pay up. So that, to me, marks the collapse of the American dream, and he's an artist that actually captures that really well throughout his paintings, that class that we don't want to talk about, the economic problem.
How old are you?
I'm 42, just turned 43.
So 1989 was Tiananmen Square, where the Communist Party basically crushed any kind of rebellion, and you know, it's almost as though the last historical thing that happened in China that the West is particularly interested in, because since then all we've done is like enjoy the fruits of their cheap labor and, you know, buy all bunch of cheap plastic stuff and pay really little attention to their politics. Who is this artist? The piece is, it's a brown shirt on the wall. It's kind of creased. It has these orange stains on it that look a bit like wax or tomato, bits of tomato paste. And the tag is still on it, so it's a new shirt. And below it is a Chinese poem in a frame. The artist is called Fun Yi Lik Eric. And what's the piece called?
I don't think it has a title yet. The piece is a reference to it was made in Xinjiang region.
Xinjiang is that Xinjiang. So that's a word you see on a lot of labels.
Yes, and it's a region in China. It's supposed to be the autonomous zone, but there are some conflicts between the population that lives there. The Turkestan is the other name of it. And there are conflicts between the region and the way that it wants to, you know, be an autonomous region, and the way that the mainland China, I guess, allows them to be autonomous is in conflict. And so as a result of that, oftentimes people are sent to work in camps that are facilities where they are re-educated, re-education centers. So some of the garments that we wear come from the labor of these people who didn't agree with the way that they ought to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And watermelon, those marks you see are watermelons that are soaked, the shirts are soaked in that, and it's a reference to the flesh and the blood of the people that we wear on our backs. And so the shirt that we wear is literally soaked in their sweat and blood and flesh.
And then the poem below is by a Chinese general, a military hero and poet. How does the artist relate the shirt to the poem?
The poem talks about the northern tribes, and it is critical of the society's reluctance to acknowledge. So I don't want to destroy it by translating, but it says, we would eat their flesh if we had to, if we were to benefit from it without any remorse. So it is critical, but at the same time, the voice and the language is almost as if he still thinks of these people like, thinks of them as lesser, but still wants to come to terms with how wrong it is to exploit them in this way. So the piece completes the shirt, gives it meaning, of course. We're thinking for the show we might want to print an English version of it, and we're still thinking about how to present that.
Two artists, that kind of their work goes together. One is drawings from East Berlin, I think you said?
Mm-hmm.
And the other is a series of names on gray squares that are pricked out with a needle or a knife. So they're sort of embossed names. Just who are the artists?
So the embossed names are from Lenka Holikova. She's also an artist from the Czech Republic. And she was born in a border town that is 7 kilometers from Germany. And the names She has about 288 people that she works on embossing the names who have lost their lives trying to escape, trying to cross the border.
Were they running across like the woodland? This wasn't in Berlin at the wall. This was in the countryside?
It would have been the woodlands, yes. And from what she describes, and of course she would have been like 5 years old at the time, or, well, when the wall came down, she was five, she said. So people have stepped on mines or electrocuted with the fences, and that's how they lost their lives. So all these people's, it wasn't like they were trying to cross over a wall, but trying to overcome a bunch of landmines and razor sharp fences and electric fences and barbed wire. And so those are the names of the people that she points and pins. And the only way to see them is when you hang it up, when the light hits the surface in such an angle where you see it illuminated, but then they fade as if they never were here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just ghostly. Whereas this other piece here, the artist, and this all happened through a response to the call. It wasn't like we went and looked. Hagen Klenart is an artist who was born in East Germany, who escaped and if you've ever seen those documentaries of people who have escaped, it's actually really scary, but he somehow made it. In 1985, he did, and he's a survivor. So we have an artist who gave us a lot of names of people who didn't make it, with an artist who's actually alive, who sent us work that he's done in the 90s talking about that era.
Mm-hmm. So these are pencil sketches. They're kind of childlike, someone in a car where there's only one wheel, somebody else setting himself on fire, but the fire is just a big red paint blob. And then there's another guy saluting with, I don't know what's going on there. These are kind of traumatic memories, do you think?
They are. They're very rough and raw, and they're actually drawn on newsprint, which is acidic. It's paper that eats itself away, which is, it's an interesting choice to do, where the artist at the time, I guess, wasn't really when everything falls apart around you, last thing you think about is the acid content of the paper. But somehow it falls together so well that like even the surface that it is drawn on is going to eventually eat itself away.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they are really, really raw. And like this one, for example, is called Death in a New Car. And that would have been probably someone trying to escape and would have been shot.
The last piece is one of these magical conceptual pieces that is actually nothing. So you're going to have a space in the middle of the room with nothing there, but on the guide it'll explain. So who's the artist?
The artist is Vladan Kuzmanović. He's a conceptual artist from Serbia. And his work is a non-piece. And he regularly does a non-exhibition and a non-art. And he's an artist that is really interested in the invisible. And thinking about his work in relation to the rest of the show and about all of these stories and how things came together, well, Yugoslavia in the heart of Europe suffered a traumatic effect of that collapse, where it's hard to explain beyond words, where the violence and the bloodshed and the country being torn into three, and we've heard stories of people getting passports from each of them, hoping one would stick and buy them a way out and survive. So his work being of nothing in the middle of all of this is kind of a way to like, well, how much can you say in a group show about what happened there? You just gotta know that. And when you've lost everything, do you really want to make a physical thing about that work to take with you as a memorabilia? So, and that's why we decided to place his non-art or nothing piece in the middle of the gallery. it will be on the floor sheet as a guide when, you know, with the information along with all the other pieces. But when you stand in the middle of the space to look at all of this, you would be standing right on top of his conceptual work.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Ilka Demira
Kuparan.
Ilka Demirkupuran. She runs the Ministry of Post-Collapse Art and Culture Gallery and Think Tank with her sister, Vuslat D. Katsanis, who lives in Seattle.
Olympia, Washington.
Who lives in Olympia, Washington. And the show they've put on is called 1989. It runs October the 8th through November 29th at the in the Ford Building on Division. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus in person.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hand him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
La radio de KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 12 de octubre del 2021. Médicos Sin Fronteras acusa a los Estados Unidos de acumular casi 500 millones de dosis en exceso de vacunas COVID-19. El grupo estima que se podrían salvar casi 1 millón de vidas durante el próximo año si los Estados Unidos y otras naciones ricas comenzaran a distribuir rápidamente el exceso de dosis a las naciones de bajos ingresos. Por otro lado, los líderes del sur del mundo criticaron la inequidad de las vacunas el lunes en el lanzamiento de una cumbre de 2 días en Belgrado para conmemorar el 6º aniversario del movimiento.